Radio Real. Real radio, your reality. Welcome to Radio Real's production of the interview in Second Life in the Bradburyville Sim between Professor Lauren Logsdon of Eureka College and Mr. Tom Peters. This is the second in a series of three programs about the writer Ray Bradbury and his works Dandelion Wine and Fahrenheit 451. This program was recorded on Sunday, October 12th, 2008. Good evening, Radio Real listeners. This is Gabrielle Real, and I am broadcasting live on Radio Real's main stream. I am here in the Bradburyville Sim in Second Life, and this is our second week of the Ray Bradbury special programming that we're bringing to you on behalf of the Second Life Library and the Alliance Library System. This will be number two. Next week we have session number three with Maxito Ricardo and Professor Lauren Logsdon. Welcome, gentlemen, and please take it away.
Thank you, Gabrielle.
Thanks, Gabrielle. This is Tom Peters, Maxito Ricardo in Second Life. Welcome you to the second of three lectures, Sunday evening lectures, with Dr. Lauren Logsdon, a professor of English at Eureka College in Illinois, Central Illinois. Before we get started, I want to thank Lorelei Juneau from the Alliance Library System and Daisy Blue Heffelman. Those are their Second Life names, for all the work they've done to bring Bradburyville to life here in Second Life, and also for organizing this series of discussions. So we're going to get started this evening, and tonight's topic is Dandelion Wine, Ray Bradbury's novel Dandelion Wine, first published in 1957, I believe, so it's about 51 years old now, and maybe Professor Logsdon can tell us, but I think it was sort of written over a period of years in the late 40s and early 50s, and then kind of came to fruition in the late 50s. So first of all, Professor Logsdon, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. I've been looking forward to this evening, and I've got a bunch of notes. I've got my copy of Dandelion Wine and my Ray Bradbury Companion, so I'm eager to go.
Okay, thanks. Well, last week we were just talking about Ray Bradbury the man, and talking about his life and especially his two visits to Eureka College in the 1990s. We both sort of, I guess, declared our love for this novel, Dandelion Wine. So tonight we're going to sort of express our love, I guess, for this novel and hope we don't bore everyone to tears. I should mention to folks that we are recording tonight's chat, and Professor Locke is actually at his kitchen table, so you need to imagine something. Imagine an English professor sitting at his kitchen table with a bunch of notes spread out around him, and like you said, his copy of Dandelion Wine and his Ray Bradbury Companion. So let's dive into this wonderful novel. It's a very charming novel and a very profound novel. Professor Logsdon, last week you mentioned that you thought that one of the key themes or messages of this novel is the nature of human happiness. And so let's talk about that, and you can start any way you want. But, of course, there's the what's his name? Leo Offman, I believe, is the man who tries to and actually does build something like a happiness machine. So there are some overt instances of attempts to achieve human happiness in this novel, correct?
Tom, before we look at happiness, I did want to tell the listeners that I've taught this novel so many times, and I began teaching really at Western Illinois University around the early 1970s after I'd finished my doctorate. And just to give the readers, viewers, some kind of idea here, more students have commented to me about that novel at the end of class, saying that that was the one novel in the whole class that they enjoyed reading the most. And that message was pretty consistent from students over the years. And I would have to say it's my favorite book to teach. Okay, about happiness, I think I will refer to something outside of Dandelion Wine. This is not in Dandelion Wine. Bradbury has a short story called Kaleidoscope. And Kaleidoscope features a man named Hollis. And Hollis is way out in space. He's on a spaceship, and there's an explosion. And the spaceship, in its explosion, sends the various astronauts in different directions. And they're falling, of course, to their death. But they're in contact with each other. And Hollis is one of the characters in Ray Bradbury's fiction, whom we might call the person who never lived. Now, the person who never lived, of course, had a physical existence, but that was about it. Didn't go beyond that. And as Hollis falls toward his death, they're all falling toward their death, he gets in an argument with a colleague named Lesphier. And Hollis says to Lesphier, who has lived a full life, what good does that do you now? You're going to die. What good does it do you now? And Lesphier says, I've had my memories. And what that does is it brings home to Hollis that he's never done anything. He's never lived. He's always wanted to do things and postpone it. And so as Hollis is falling to his death, he makes a wish. He says, I wish I could do something before I die that would be of help to someone else. And as he's falling, he realizes that when he reaches Earth's atmosphere, he's going to burn up. He, of course, he's falling. And down on Earth, Bradbury switches the perspective to a little child down on Earth who's looking up at the heavens at this time, at the very time Hollis enters the atmosphere and burns. And the mother of the child who is with the child says, look, a falling star, make a wish. And, of course, they're wishing on Hollis. It's Hollis who is the star, actually. So Hollis, without his knowledge, has done something good to somebody. But Dandelion Wine provides us with meaningful answers to two questions, two really important questions. First is, what is the best way to live that makes us happy? What is happiness? What is the best way we can live to achieve that happiness? The second question, which really enables readers to see that the book is profound and not just a children's book, is how can we come to terms with the knowledge that we will one day die? In other words, those two questions, what is happiness and how can we come to terms with the knowledge we will one day die? These are crucial questions. They're not just, this is not just a book for children, in other words, it's a book for adults as well. And so the essential idea of the book is, what is happiness? And I would propose that happiness is based on our ability to realize that life is mystery and miracle. Happiness consists in Dandelion Wine in three main things. First, our eyes have to be opened to see life as mystery and miracle. Okay. Second, happiness enables us to live fully in the present moment. Happiness consists of living fully in the present moment. And third, happiness enables us to recognize that it can be defined. Happiness can be defined only in relation to other people. So this is a kind of thumbnail sketch of I think, what Bradbury sees as happiness in this novel. It's a combination of all three of those things. And the lack of happiness is the opposite of those things. It's a selfishness. It's a self-centeredness. It's also selfish. It's an inability to see life as mystery, and it is something which prevents us from living fully in the present moment. That's my general definition of happiness as Bradbury pronounces it in Dandelion Wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
that's a long answer.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on there. And so let's take the, for example, like the instance where Leo Offman gets a bee in his bonnet that he's going to build a happiness machine. And what he does is he sort of either builds a, he builds a machine that basically shows other places like Paris and Egypt and has wonderful smells emitted from the machine and sounds. It's a very sensory experience. But it fails miserably in the sense that when people enter his happiness machine, they often begin to weep. And his son sneaks in there sort of the night that he finishes it. Leo finishes it. His son sneaks in the middle of the night, and he ends up back in his bed just weeping uncontrollably. And his father figures out that he's been in the quote-unquote happiness machine. And his wife, his long-suffering wife, Lena, also goes in the machine, and she begins to weep as well. And I think you're right in the fact that I think Lena is sort of the voice of wisdom in that episode. And she says to him, "You've shown me Paris, and I knew at the back of my mind that I would never get to Paris, but you've shown it to me, and you've brought that to my attention that I'm not there." And so that's kind of against that precept that you say, not being fully in the present, fully in the here and now, fully right there in Greentown, Illinois. His quote-unquote happiness machine actually draws people away from where they are. Now, I don't think Bradbury, I don't think alludes to this directly, but you have to think, I'm kind of building up the Fahrenheit 451, the discussion for next Sunday evening, that Bradbury may have television in mind, because television brings us, you know, the war in Iraq and the Super Bowl and things that we're experiencing them sort of vicariously or from a distance. And even perhaps Second Life, where here I am sitting on a dais in an auditorium, but I'm looking out at about a dozen fellow avatars here and talking to you at your kitchen table there. But I'm also sitting here on the eastern slope of Monkey Mountain in western Missouri. So I sort of have a divided attention. I'm actually feeling pretty happy right now, but I think the point here is that when you think about the places that you can't be and the experiences that you can't have, that draws your attention away from the here and now, and you become a little bit unhappy or momentarily unhappy. And you know, remember at the end of that episode that Leo sort of gets it after his machine breaks up, and there's a great scene where Lena he tells his son, one of his sons, don't call the fire department, and then Lena, his wife, grabs the son and says, "Oh, wait a minute here, let it burn a little bit before we call the fire department." And of course, the whole garage burns down, and she's happy about that. And he, after he ponders a little bit, is happy as well, and he ends up pointing to Douglas Spaulding, who's the main character in the novel. His grandfather, Douglas, and I think Tom, his younger brother, are the last ones to sort of linger over the ashes with Leo. And Leo looks into his home, and he sees they have a bunch of kids, I don't know, six or eight kids. And he sees, you know, two kids are playing chess, and one kid is practicing the piano, and his wife is making dinner. And he said, "That's happiness, not Paris in springtime and all those other things I tried to build into my happiness machine. It's right here, it's right now in this family." And so I think that sort of ties into with your top-level kind of explication of what happiness means in this novel.
You mentioned a lot of things there, Tom, really a lot of things, and pick up on as many of them as I can. You're right, next week is going to be more into machines per se, but Bradbury has always had a dim view of machines, and he's always questioned whether they really have human objectives or not, whether machines can assist us in reaching human objectives. He takes a dim view. In fact, there's only two examples of good machines in all of Bradbury's fiction. One is the grandmother, the mechanical grandmother, and I Sing the Body of the Electric. And the other is a story that I wrote an article about It's called the Kilimanjaro machine. And those are the only two stories I can think of where he has a machine. But you're right in your point. You made a point that the machine in Leo, the machine that Leo Elfman creates, takes people away from each other. It puts them in the machine and it closes them off from other people. And so that's bad in Bradbury's work. In other words, happiness must be defined in relation to other people. And if you remember, in that story, after the machine burns up, Leo has learned a lesson from Lena, who is the voice of wisdom in this story. But he takes Grandpa Spaulding and Doug and Tom up on his front porch, and he points in, looks in the window, and points to his children, who are doing various things and so forth, and his wife is in there. And he says, there's the true happiness machine. And of course it is. It is, as Bradbury sees it. The true happiness machine is a family. It's other people. And so your point is right about enclosing people, or rather taking them away from other people. Seems to me the novel says that, Tom, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that the whole theme of loneliness is really central to this novel. And of course we have the lonely one, this sort of serial killer that's been terrorizing the town of people haven't read the book. I haven't read it in years or decades. The novel is set in a town called Greentown, Illinois. Most mm-hmm. people think, and I think Ray, you know, admitted that it's based upon his hometown of Waukegan, Illinois, which is now a northern suburb of the Chicago metropolitan area. And it's the summer of 1928, basically from like early June till the end of August. So it's summertime. And the main character is Douglas Spaulding, who's 12 years old during the course of the story. And it's about all the experiences that he has. And there's some other related experiences that don't really involve Doug that are occurring in this town during the summer of 1928. So it's, pre-stock market crash, or I should say the stock market crash of 1929. It's also pre-stock market crash of 2008, too, but it was pre-1929 as well. So it's the late 20s, and, it's a time that, small town life back in the early 20th century was very, I think it left an indelible impression on a lot of people. My parents grew up in small towns in the 1920s and 1930s in the Midwest, and they still talk about life in those small towns and the characters and reading about these characters, the junk man, the junk man that goes around town, and the little old ladies, and all that stuff. Just it could be almost anywhere in the Midwest in the 1920s, 1930s. But I want to come back to this theme of loneliness, and so we have the lonely one. But I just want to read a passage. If I could just bore you with this, but there are many wonderful scenes in this novel. But there's this scene where Doug has been out past dark when he should be home. It's early on in the novel. It's on page 43 of the paperback edition I'm looking at. And his mother and his younger brother, Tom, who's 10, go out looking for him. And his father's off, I think, at a lodge meeting of some sort. Mm-hmm. So his father's not in the house. And so his mother is increasingly concerned about Doug's well-being. And she ends up going out with Tom in the dark to look for him. And there's a ravine in town that is absolutely essential to this novel. We could talk about this. Let me get through this loneliness thing and have you comment on it, Professor. But I also want to come back and talk about the ravine, which I think is part wilderness sort of intruding on the town, but also evil and chaos and subconscious. There's a lot of stuff going on with the ravine. The ravine is a very rich symbol, I think, in the novel. But so Doug's mother and Tom have come to the edge of this ravine. And here's this wonderful passage about loneliness. This is Tom sort of thinking here. The essential impact of life's loneliness crushed his beginning to tremble body. Mother was alone, too. She could not look to the security of marriage, the protection of her family's love, She could not look to the United States Constitution or the city police. She could not look anywhere. In this very instant, save into her heart. And there she would find nothing but uncontrollable repugnance and a will to fear. In this instance, it was an individual problem seeking an individual solution. He must accept being alone and work on from there. So there's one aspect of loneliness. And then about three paragraphs later, it goes on. There were a million small towns like this all over the world, each as dark as lonely, each as removed, as full of shuddering and wonder. The reedy playing of minor key violins was the small town's music, with no lights but many shadows. Oh, the vast swelling loneliness of them, the secret damp ravines of them. Life was a horror lived in them at night, when at all sides, sanity, marriage, children, happiness, were threatened by an ogre called death. Professor Logsdon, your thoughts on that passage and that scene, that terrifying scene for mother and younger son.
That passage you read is one of the central passages in Dandelion Wine, and it's a passage that should convince readers that this is not just a book for children, that Bradbury is making an essential statement about life there that is universal. We are all alone. We're born alone. We live alone. We'll die alone. And no amount of police protection, no amount of other things will prevent that aloneness, that feeling from being alone. But as you see, Bradbury's wisdom here is very practical. You just start from there and go on and you do the best you can, even though you know you're alone. Now, friendship and happiness and so forth can help you, but essentially we are alone. I connect this passage with a passage where Doug is on the porch late at night and the family is all around him, and he has this wonderful feeling of well-being as though he's protected. The adults are talking. They aren't particularly noticing him. But it's just this feeling of being a part of the human race, and Doug feels good about it. What Bradbury says and what you read is you accept that and you just go on from there. You do whatever you can. But that passage is profound. And I want to make another comment, Tom, about that. If you notice, as you read this book, Bradbury uses Tom and Doug Spaulding for comparison and contrast purposes. Tom here is making a discovery that children make at this point in their life when they discover they're alone. But Tom he's a different type of person than Doug. Tom is a practical person. Now, Tom thinks that he keeps records of everything he does, and he thinks that he can control life by keeping those records. If you remember, Tom is very proud of one thing he has, which no other boy in Illinois has, and that's a snowflake. He has, in a matchbox in the icebox, he has taken a snowflake from winter, put it in the icebox, and he's the only boy in Illinois who has one. Well, that's kind of cute, but it's not really the way life goes. In other words, snowflakes are appropriate in winter, not in summer. And so Tom is trying to do that which is impossible, and that's put a control on life. Life cannot be controlled. Life is to be lived, not controlled. And so that is a powerful theme that goes throughout the book. Those people who try to control life, as Leo Alfman does with the happiness machine, make a very sad mistake. It's dangerous to try to impose a control over life because life is so impermanent. But I'm glad you read that passage, Tom, because that introduces readers to the idea that this is a serious book, and Bradbury is really making some important statements about life and how life is to be lived. So,
yeah, I think
good
so
for
too.
You for and, reading it.
Thanks. It really is a moving passage. I probably didn't do justice to it, but every time I read it, I'm just so moved by that passage. And there are other things too in this book that I'm always moved by. But let me tell you a little story and then ask you a question. This is probably the fourth or fifth time that I've read this book, and I love this book. It's right up there with, like, Huck Finn is another book that I've gotten to the point where, and maybe it's the fact that they're both perhaps like episodic books, but I've gotten to the point with both books that I can, you know, I think about them often, and I have some favorite scenes. And occasionally I'll sit down and reread these books over again in their entirety, but often I'll just dip into various sections that I know and love, and they sort of revive me or something, or you know, they're just affirming something. I say, yeah, that is great literature or whatever. In Huck Finn, the Emmeline Grangerford episode just makes me laugh out loud every time I read it and reread it and experience it. Reading this book, I reread it now about a month or so ago, and I sort of went into thinking, I love this book, but let me try to practice what I call tough love with the books that I love and love to reread. And I started to ask us some questions, and I sort of was playing devil's advocate with this book. And one of the things I was saying is, I was asking myself, is this really a novel in the sense that there's a plot here? Or is there sort of underlying some unity to this? Does it rise to some climax and then there's a denouement? Kinds of things that we typically expect in a novel, or is this just a series of tightly woven short stories and episodes that often have the same characters and are set in the same place? And after reading this, I think that it is a novel. The idea I want to throw out and have you comment on. I think it is a novel, and I think that one of the things that happens in this course of the novel, Doug, I think, is the main character, and his experience and his revelations are key to the novel. Early on, Doug and his father and his brother Tom are out picking berries. I forget whether it's raspberries or wild blueberries, or they're out in the woods picking berries. And Doug has this experience where he, one of those moments where you realize you're fully alive. It's kind of this, as you mentioned, later on in the novel, he's on the porch at night. He feels so bonded to his family and his town and his time that he just feels totally alive. And I think the first episode that I experience in this novel where I say, yeah,
that's
he's
a good
really,
one.
He's
that
really
is
alive
a good one.
Here. And he's very conscious that he's alive at that point where that, you know, that it hits him. I'm alive. And that's really early, early on in the novel. So the novel sort of begins with the revelation that he's alive. And then in the course of the novel, he experiences loss. His best friend moves away. His great-grandmother dies, Colonel Fairley dies, he experiences change and loss and death. And then he comes to the conclusion, and it's almost like a syllogistic, I don't have the passage marked here, but it's a very, almost like a syllogistic, a short chapter where he basically says, things change, people die, people move away, ergo, I'm going to die. And so he has this, whereas earlier in the novel he has this full realization, I'm alive. Later in the novel he has this full realization, I'm going to die. And then he develops this fever, and he almost does die. So for me, this kind of life-death realization is what is really the plot of the novel, and that is what makes it a novel for me, is this theme of life and death that Doug goes through in the course of the novel. So your thoughts on that?
You just set up the perfect reason for its being a novel. That is a good question, though, Tom, and that's what students have asked me over the years several times. Is it a novel or just a collection of short stories? Now, it's comparable to Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, which has a collection of short stories, but which is really a novel. And you pointed to I think the first thing I would point to answer the question, is it a novel? Doug's discovery that he's alive. And there's another discovery that you have to make after you make that one. And that is the discovery that if you're alive and one day you will die. And so Doug's growth over the summer is what makes this a novel. It's what unites all the stories in here. It's his growth to maturity. See, Bradbury, if you could envision a blackboard, Bradbury divides people, human beings, into three categories. First would be children from birth to about 13. Second would be the middle category, which would be 13 to about 70. And then the last category would be people 70 to 95, because we have a 95-year-old woman in, who I guess from what you said is one of your favorite characters. But there are these stages in life. And we begin with Doug Spaulding, who's a child. Now, there are some great advantages to being children. Children are, for those of us who are religious, children are closer to God. Children are new to life. Children are capable of being surprised and looking at life as something awesome. When we reach late adolescence and adulthood, we're more concerned about practical things. And so Bradbury, by and large, isn't concerned with the middle group of people, that is the adolescents and the adults. He is concerned with the young people, the children, and the old people. And this brings in the metaphor of dandelion wine. For Bradbury, dandelion wine is a metaphor for the way to live one's life. The gathering of dandelions represents life's experiences. Each dandelion is a kind of experience. So it goes into the winemaking process so that the end of one's life, if you have lived a happy, fulfilled life, you should be like a rare, fine bottle of dandelion wine. And so what unites this seemingly episodic book is Doug Spaulding's attempt to face the question of death. He becomes aware that he's alive, but his problem then is to come to terms with death. And you read the passage where that is very clear, that Doug has to find some answer to enable him to cope with death so that he can go on living. When his great-grandma dies and he realizes that all the machines have failed, that people have moved away or else died, then he comes face-to-face with the idea that he must die. He will die someday. And that idea, that movement of the novel, from Doug's awareness that he is alive to the realization that he will die, is what gives this book a unity. Now, I have to be honest with you, Tom. Bradbury wrote some of these as short stories before he published the book. And in fact, Malcolm Bradbury, who's no relation to Ray, urged him to write, to put them together into a novel. And Bradbury finally did. But it is a novel in the sense that it focuses on Doug's growth. It focuses on Doug's ability to find an answer to that question which plagues all of us. How do we go on living in terms of our knowledge that we will die? Mm-hmm. That is a human problem, a universal human problem, and a very important one. Mm-hmm. So I would say that you yourself have provided some of the scenes which I use to convince students that this really is a novel.
Yeah, I agree. I think I've come to the conclusion after thinking about this and asking the tough love question, is this really a novel? I think it really is a novel, and a very good novel at that. Another tough love question that I asked this novel upon my most recent reading was this whole issue of nostalgia. And I could imagine some people saying, oh, this is just Ray Bradbury being nostalgic about his own boyhood, and it's treacly, it's almost to the point of being maudlin. What's so great about this novel? It's just a nostalgia trip for Ray. And my response to that is, and, you know, again, I'm just trying to bounce this idea off of you, is that No, it's not just him being nostalgic about his own boyhood. I mean, he was born in August of 1920, I believe, and so he would have been seven going on eight, turning eight during the summer of 1928. So Tom's 10 and Doug's 12, so who knows, you know, I'll leave it to, you know, people to sort of draw any parallels they want to with Ray's own life and how autobiographical it is. But I don't think that nostalgia is treacly at all. I think that and there's another theme going on here, what I call memory and discovery, where a ritual and discovery, where throughout the summer there are certain things that are ritualistic, the making of dandelion wine, the putting of the porch swing out at the first, you know, in early June, and the taking it down at the end of the summer. There's just a whole series of the first mowing of the lawns. There's a whole series of rituals, summertime rituals, that go on throughout this book. And then there's also all of the discoveries and illuminations that primarily Doug has, but other characters have during this particular summer, that are like new revelations to them. And like you say, Doug is he's trying to get it all down. He's writing furiously in his notebook late at night, all the different things that he's experienced. And I really appreciate your comment about the difference between young age and old age, where there's this wonderful passage where Doug is talking about all the, he almost remembers vividly each day of the summer. He's late in the summer, and he's talking to his grandpa about this, and his grandpa only is like, what? Oh, yeah, it just flew by, didn't it? And the only thing he remembers was that one episode where I think it was the newspaper man tried to sell him some sod that would never need cutting, or some grass seed that would never need cutting. So he has one memory of this from the summer of 1928, whereas Doug has all these memories. And I think I'm in that forgotten middle-aged group right now, but or the discounted middle-aged group. I was just thinking about when you're young, summer is endless, you know.
Yes.
But when you get to be 50 years old, it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, here it is October already, and Halloween's coming up, and what happened to summer? And so that your sense of time and the passage of time really differs between when you're young and when you're old, I think. So, but what about this tough love question of mine, and the people that might say this is just a nostalgia trip for Ray Bradbury and nothing more? How do you respond to that?
Well, nostalgia, certainly it's there. I asked Bradbury about this book once, and he said, I wrote it by free association. He said, I just associated one thing with another. And of course, he's looking back to his life and connecting things. But I think it's more than nostalgia. It's certainly nostalgia, of course. I mean, we all do that with our childhood, looking back on our childhood and picking out those wonderful moments and so forth. But what this book illustrates, I think in a very profound way, is one of the traditional ways that children have been introduced to wisdom is through stories and examples. And as you mentioned, rituals. This book is full of rituals. And a way that a young person gains knowledge of the world and gains a wisdom, if you will, is through stories. It's through stories and rituals. And if you notice, when Grandfather Spaulding puts up the porch swing, he's got the boys with him. They're with him. And they're participating in this ritual. That is, for him, the beginning of spring, when he has them gathering the dandelions. They are there with him participating in this ritual, which is so important to the summer. And notice there are three winemaking scenes, one for each month of the summer. We gain knowledge and wisdom through participating in meaningful rituals. And the adults, the old people, communicate their knowledge this way to the children in rituals. And so I think it's a little, it's nostalgia, certainly, Tom. I think one of Ray's biographers wrote that in Dandelion Wine, Ray discovered the magic of memory. That's certainly true. That's certainly a way of describing Dandelion Wine. But I think beyond that and deeper than that is the importance of stories told to children and rituals observed by children. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I think it's more than nostalgia.
Yeah, I think so, too.
In Dandelion Wine.
Yeah, I think so,
it's
too.
It's nostalgia plus wisdom. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I think we're in agreement on that. But there's certainly nostalgia there, and I sort of wonder sometimes what, I don't know if this is still assigned reading in like high school senior literature classes or not, but I sort of wonder what today's kids make of this novel. Because I'm 50, and when I was growing up, my parents and grandparents would talk about small town life. This seemed very familiar to me because I had heard adults talking about this kind of life when I was growing up. But I sort of imagine now that the kids are sort of too far removed from that time. This is now 80 years ago, 1928, that they may not have, I don't know how to put it, direct passed on knowledge about this time and in our nation's history and that small town life in the early 20th century, that I wonder if it seems a little too more foreign to them than it does to me. Does that make sense? You know, there's a point where human memory is passed on, just becomes too attenuated to be as perhaps vivid as I think it is to me.
Well, even more than that, Tom, you hit upon something early in the hour when you mentioned the happiness machine isolating people. I think children today and people in general are more and more isolated from each other through the machines of modern life. For example, television really isolates us. When we're watching the TV, we're not talking with people. We're not doing things with people. We're doing one thing. We're watching the TV. The video games isolate children from each other. And so I think there is an impoverishment, if you will, in modern life that comes from the way we are isolated in modern life. And Bradbury, you're right, there is all of this history that is somehow passed on from the older people to the younger people, and it's passed on through human contact with each other, through the stories and so forth. So I think I would add that to your point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
we are isolated. That's what you were saying about the happiness machine. It isolates Lena, for example, when she goes in there. She's isolated in the machine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yep. I think, we probably could talk for an hour just about, the changes that are described or the culture that's described in this book and the changes, some of the changes that are hinted at. So, for example, like what I call front porch culture, where people would sit out on the front porch of an evening and, you just don't. It's sort of gotten so bad. I won't sit on the fence. It's gotten so bad that most houses don't even have front porches anymore. They just have entryways. So it's just the front porch has sort of evolved into just a way to get into and out of the house, sort of a main entrance kind of thing, and not a porch where you would sit. We could talk about why that happened. I think air conditioning changed things. The various forms of entertainment that we have now that. I think the whole culture, the front porch culture, has just gone away pretty much in most parts, especially in the Midwest. And then there's also like some very good things where the trolley is being replaced by the bus system in Waukegan in the summer of 1928. So we sort of see things changing, in the course of the novel. And there's some things that are describing the novel that just aren't there anymore in our culture.
Well, I think the changes are there, certainly, but not in this novel, Tom. Not as this novel ends on a very happy note, a very positive note. If you notice, when Aunt Rose arrives and she messes up Grandma's cooking, and Aunt Rose then becomes the villain, and Doug knows what to do. He hides the glasses, hides the cookbook, messes up her kitchen again. And so Aunt Rose is defeated and sent packing, literally. Here's your bag, Aunt Rose. Here's the ticket to the train. Get lost. The changes in this book do occur, but essentially the community is affirmed at the end. The community is threatened by Aunt Rose. Incidentally, she represents the efficiency of the machine. Aunt Rose, see, the machine has as its objective efficiency. And Aunt Rose is going to make Grandma's cooking even better because she's going to organize it. She's going to give Grandma glasses and a cookbook and so forth. That's a machine intruding, really, on something that's good and destroying something that's good. But yeah. Doug saves the day. So a potential change to destroy something valuable in the community is halted, and the community is reaffirmed. So this novel doesn't suggest the kinds of changes you might expect coming. For example, it doesn't anticipate the stock market crash. It doesn't anticipate a lot of things. It ends in affirmation, and Doug's actions affirm the community. So right. I don't think Bradbury is particularly warning us at the end of this novel about the changes that can come from the machines and isolation. He's more concerned with conveying to us the sense of Doug's achieving maturity. Now, if I can get my book here and find the place, well, I don't need the book. I remember the passage anyway. But toward the end of Dandelion Wine, Grandpa Spaulding and Tom and Doug are together, and they're talking about the summer. And Tom says, I can remember everything that happened to me in the summer. Grandpa Spaulding says, of course you can, Tom, and knowing there's no use to argue with this kid. Grandpa Spaulding can remember only one thing, and that was Bill Forrester's attempt to do away with lawn mowing because it was a threat to Grandpa Spaulding's happiness. Doug says something there to Tom. He says, I have a hunch that next year's going to be even better. People dying, more babies being born, and me in the middle of it all. That passage confirms that Doug has achieved a maturity, because one of the things he's been fighting all throughout the novel is to somehow find a way that he will be granted immortality. He won't have to die. What that passage says so succinctly, and Bradbury is so great at this, Doug has accepted his place in the middle of things. And notice death, people dying, more babies being born, the idea of impermanence, change being made. But these are life changes that we can't control. And so it's not a threat of machines per se. It's an affirmation of the human spirit. It's an affirmation of human life and so forth at the end, Tom. I don't think Bradbury is warning us in this book.
Yeah.
In Dandelion Wine.
Yeah, I think of those two passages that come to mind. You mentioned the one where Grandfather loudly rejects Bill Forster's attempt to push grass seed on him that doesn't need to ever be cut because the mowing of lawns is one of life's little pleasures for Grandfather. So, you know, he sort of gives Bill Forster a little dissertation on happiness at that point, too, is that, you know, you think we're often exhorted to pay attention to the big things in life, you know, marriage and, your retirement fund and, you know, all those big things in life that you're supposed to be concentrating on. But I think what Grandpa is saying, and I think what Ray is telling us, is that now it's the little things, the new pair of sneakers, the mowing of lawn, the smell of that, the front porch culture in the evenings, that's what is really essential to life.
Tom, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I know that episode in this book, and it is the Bill Forrester, Helen Loomis episode in the book. I was going to ask you, why do you like that so much? You've confessed that you really like that.
Yeah. That's a good question. I think that it's a love story that is rarely depicted in literature, but
well,
I would say
it is a wonderful
profound
love story, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's so profound. I think it's just I think. Well, two things. I think that Ray Bradbury, one of the things I love about Ray Bradbury is he has moments of stylistic brilliance that just knock me over.
Mm-hmm.
There's some passages in Fahrenheit 451. There's some passages here. You know, the one I read, that knocks me over. It's such a powerful passage. And I think that whole chapter with the May-December love affair between Helen Loomis and Bill Forrester is just an extended, excellent piece of writing. I think also one thing I really like in literature is what I call set pieces, where they almost can stand on their own, and they're just so well done that, you know, like the Emmeline Granger Ford episode in Huck Finn, and this episode in Dandelion Wine. I mean, we could go through literature and just talk about those really amazing set pieces in literature. And I think this is just that chapter is an outstanding example of a set piece.
Mm-hmm. You're a young sentimentalist, Tom. No, just kidding. Just kidding. But do you know what Bradbury does that's brilliant in that section, in addition to all the things you've said? Remember Bill Forrester when we saw him earlier in the novel? Remember he was going to plant this special grass that would grow only to a certain height, and you wouldn't have to mow it. There's the ultimate in practicality, okay? In other words, Bill Forrester is using a practical solution to a problem here, mowing the grass. You don't have to mow it anymore. Grandpa Spaulding kind of shakes him up a bit, wakes him up, and so forth. And when Bill Forrester meets Helen Loomis, the most impractical thing that you could ever imagine is a 35-year-old man falling in love with a 95-year-old woman. That would never happen unless the woman was really rich or something and the man was loving her because of her money. But Forrester's eyes have been opened up here to a mystery. And notice how beautiful that is. He fell in love with her because he saw a picture of her when she was a young woman.
Uh-huh.
And she's embarrassed by that, of course, and she said, I feel like I'm a dragon who has eaten up a lovely swan. And you look at the dragon, and you can maybe see a few feathers of the swan around the dragon's mouth, but you can't see the swan. Well, in one of the most, I think, beautiful situations, Bill Forrester and Helen are talking, and Helen and Bill kind of turns his head a certain way, looks at Helen, and he says, for a moment there, I think I saw it. Mm-hmm. And she says, what, saw what? He doesn't say in words, he pantomimes the words, the swan.
Mm-hmm.
And see, his eyes have been opened to mystery and miracle. Life is mystery and miracle. And what better testimony of his awakening when he looks at a dragon and he can see the swan? Isn't that marvelous?
Yeah, and I think that Ray has set us up for that wonderful scene in many ways. Like you say, Bill Forrester is sort of he's getting his midlife education too, I think, in the course of this novel. And also remember this, I forget the name of the woman, but remember the elderly woman, the young kids can't even believe that she was ever young. And so that episode happens before this episode. So, you know, this is sort of reaffirming, I'm 95 years old, but I could be lovely to somebody just before my death. And so it sort of I think, commenting back on that episode where the kids couldn't even believe that, I forget, Mrs. Bentley or something like that, couldn't have possibly ever been a young person.
Oh, yeah, that's great, isn't it? In other words, what you have there is something unique, and I mentioned it to Bradbury, and he didn't realize it. I said, do you realize, Ray, there are three women in all of literature who've never had a childhood, and one of them's in your book? I said, Athena from Greek mythology, Eve in the Bible, and Helen Bentley in Dandelion Wine. And he said, oh yeah? He says, I never thought of that before. And I said, it's true, right? She's never had a childhood, according to these kids, of course.
Right.
But, notice how she's contrasted with Colonel Freely. You mentioned the kids couldn't believe she was ever a young person, ever a child. Kids have no trouble believing that Freely witnessed all of those things he talks about.
Yeah, he's a time machine.
The human time machine is right. Yeah, and he's the best kind of machine because he tells the kids stories. He's a history professor, really. He tells them about the past, and he does so vividly that they think that they were actually there to see the incidents he talks about.
Yeah. Now let me, this is something I just thought of, and let me get your take on this. So, okay, you got Lena Hoffman in the Happiness Machine seeing the Paris, and she breaks out weeping.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have Colonel Fairley. He's the one who's calling down to Mexico City all the time, right? And he just wants to hear the street sounds. He asked the person, I forget who is it, their aunt, to just hold the phone out the window.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
And he spent time in Mexico City, but why does that work? Why is that life affirming? Whereas the happiness machine that's transporting Lena to Paris, although she's never been to Paris, is the ultimate unhappiness machine. Is the fact that Colonel Fairley, he's basically jogging his own memories of his time in Mexico City, correct?
Yeah, but see, Freely's legs have failed him, his body's failed him. He can't be out in the middle of it all anymore. And the closest he can come is that phone call to Mexico City. So he's out of it because of his old age and his health. But I was going to say, Tom, there are two scenes in this book that are absolute, they're absolutely brilliant. Colonel Freely's death is the hanging up of the telephone. Helen Loomis's death is the blue envelope. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
Bill is going to get the blue envelope, and that will be a sign that she's dead. But in both cases, death is a telephone that's hung up and in Mexico City and a blue envelope. I wish we could talk more about Freely, but it looks like time is almost up.
We're almost out of time, and we've mentioned the ravine, but we haven't really talked much about the ravine. And I don't think we did justice to the novel if we didn't just chat a few minutes or so about the ravine and the fact that there's evil and wildness and chaos hidden in that ravine. What are your thoughts on the ravine?
Pardon? I did.
What are your thoughts on the ravine as a real aspect of this community?
I still didn't get it, Tom. My phone is kind of wearing out, I think.
Okay. What are your thoughts on the ravine and evil in this novel?
Oh, I love this novel. I'll never get tired of teaching it. I'll never get tired of reading it. The one thing that I really like about it, I think, is Bradbury's message is open to all of us, every human being. It's not, we don't have to be great in the eyes of the world. We don't have to be professors. We don't have to be geniuses. This is a message for all people, and I think that's one of the reasons that students like it so much, because what Bradbury offers here is a magic that is open to all of us. if we'll just see what it is. But the most important thing that we have to realize is life is mystery and miracle. If we're open to that, then we're open to the richness of life that is available to all of us. And if we're aware that other people are important to our happiness, that also is a central part of his message. But the reason I think the book is so great is it is for everybody. It's not just for children. It's for adults who have forgotten what it's like to be children. It's for old people who have forgotten what it's like to be children. It's for children who can learn and gain wisdom from old people. So it's just such a marvelous book.
Yeah, I agree.
That's why I like it so much.
It's a wonderful book, and I can attest to the fact that it will stand rereading well. It'll hold its own, rereading it very frequently. We are 61 minutes into our conversation here, so we have to draw to a close. But I want to thank Professor Loren Logsdon from Eureka College for sharing with us this evening his thoughts on the wonderful novel Dandelion Wine by Ray Bradbury. Join us next week, same bat time, same bat channel, for a chat about another great Bradbury novel, Fahrenheit 451, a very different novel, I think. And as Lorelei has just put into, there's, for those of you who are in Second Life, there's going to be music and dancing at the center of Bradburyville immediately following this discussion of Dandelion Wine. So this is Tom Peters. Again, thank you everybody for attending in the various venues, and have a great evening and great week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Tom. I enjoyed talking with you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Very, very interesting conversation, Lauren. And I think that the novel is just, it's definitely a keeper.
You're a good reader, a very good reader.
It's up there in my book with Huck Finn. Great Gatsby is another one I'd sort of put in among American novels as at the very top level.
I love that one, too, in Waynesburg, Ohio. I love.
Yep, so I won't keep you, but thanks very much, and we'll talk next week about Fahrenheit 451.
Good. Look forward to it, Tom.
Take care.
You too.
Good night.
Bye.
All music in this production is from the artists on the Magnatune label. The music in the general introduction is John Playford's All in a Garden Green by Eileen Hadidian and Natalie Cox from their album Dolce Musica, A Contemplative Journey. The music in the introduction to the Bradbury interview is Within This Space by D.A.C. Crowell off of the album Within This Space. You can learn more about Magnatune on their website, magnatune.com. This entire recording is a production of Radio Real, copyright 2008. You can find us on the web at radioreal.org.